Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 264. What's happening with the latest releases of large language models? Is the industry hitting the edge of the scaling laws? And do the current benchmarks provide reliable performance assessments? This week on the show, Jody Burchell returns to discuss the current state of LLM releases. The most recent release of GPT-5 has been a wake-up call for the LLM industry. We discuss how the current scaling of these systems are reaching a diminishing edge. Jody also shares how many AI model assessments and benchmarks are flawed. We also look soberly at the productivity gains from using these tools for software development within companies. We discuss how newer developers should consider additional factors when looking at the current job market. Jody digs into how economic changes and rising interest rates are influencing layoffs and hiring freezes. We share a wide collection of resources for you to continue exploring these topics. This episode is sponsored by Influx Data. Stuck with slow time series data queries? It's not your code, it's your database. Traditional databases weren't built for timestamp data. InfluxDB was. Handle millions of data points per second while competitors wait for dashboards to load. When you use the right tool for time series data, everything becomes faster, simpler, and more effective. Stop waiting. Start building at influxdata.com/realpython. Hey there. I've got a quick request. We've created our first Real Python podcast listener survey. We're trying to learn more about you, our audience, and what you're interested in us covering on the show. It's a quick survey, less than 5 minutes. You can click the link right in the show notes on your podcast player, or visit realpython.com/podcast, and the link will be in the show notes for this episode. Thanks. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Jody, welcome back.
Hi.
I don't know. Is it 8 months, 9 months? It's been a little while. So I'm excited to have you back on the show. I know you came on near the top of the year, but I think we recorded early holidays. So how's it been? Like, do you want to talk about some of the conferences you've done? Maybe we'll link to some of them because I think some of them, the talks might relate to what we're going to cover this week.
Yeah. So I basically have been actually cutting back on the conferences this year. So I did a conference in January. I was back in Australia, actually, in May.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to be back in Melbourne, which is where I used to live.
Yeah.
And I was actually, perhaps I was slightly masochistic in signing up for this. I was co-team lead of program for EuroPython.
Wow, yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work for conferences this year. That was amazing, though. Like, that conference was incredible. Decided not to submit a talk just because I've been sort of, when you do a lot of talks, like, I don't know how other people feel, but I tend to run out of things to talk about. And I was just like,
sure,
I don't think I have anything interesting to talk about right now. So I just decided not to submit anything. But I will be doing a keynote in 2 weeks, basically talking about the history of modern AI and what it can kind of tell us about our current cycle that we're in, which is probably a very good segue, actually, for this episode.
Yeah, we were going to discuss, I guess, kind of what's going on with LLMs currently. What is going on? Our goal is not to be negative or positive one way or the other, but to kind of do a bunch of research. And we are going to provide a whole collection of articles for you to look into, some videos also. So a bunch of things where you can kind of see where we're kind of coming from and thinking about things. But it's been an interesting field to watch. I have been watching on the sidelines and kind of paying attention to a lot of things. I'm doing some dabbling here on the side. I'm actually, you know, paying money for services now and trying it out, which is, I think, something we might also have to discuss a little bit, because to get some of the things that you might want out of this stuff may require a little bit of an investment from the coding side. But a lot of this information, I think, that feeds this industry really comes from, is the general public going to use this? Are a lot of corporations going to start using this? And kind of what's happening with that is, I think, important to the rest of it, because where's the funding go if if the general public and a lot of companies aren't using this? If it's just developers using it, then that's something else. So this is a little bit of a side talk, but also I think we'll dive into, building on top of our series of NLP to LLMs to our last was about sort of talking about
sentiment analysis, I think.
Yeah, sentiment analysis. Yeah, that was a big, that was fun. So
yeah,
I guess, do you want to set the playing field?
Yeah, so I think we decided we would do this episode partially because of what happened in the aftermath of GPT-5's release, which happened very recently, just a couple of weeks ago. And for me, I've been very heavily involved in this space since the release of ChatGPT. Obviously, before that as well, in a, you know, not keeping up with the news kind of way.
Right.
You know, as a data scientist before that, but really watching the news for 3 years or so.
Yeah.
And for me, this sort of feels like probably the second big shift we've felt. The first was probably in January this year after the release of the DeepSeek models.
Yeah.
But this feels different. It feels more substantial. And it feels a bit like the hype is dying down and a lot more people are becoming cautious or perhaps a bit disillusioned with where we're going with the LLMs. So it also set the scene a bit, like, as you said, Chris, I've always been a moderate on LLMs.
Yeah.
I like them as models. I think they're super great. Do I think their abilities have been overstated? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But do I think they have a lot of useful applications? Also, absolutely. So yeah, I think maybe we can sort of have a chat about why people are feeling differently about LLMs now, whether the bubble might be bursting, and you know, where does that leave us if the bubble bursts? Like, right. I don't know, but I can have some guesses.
That's the questions I have for industry people, that what does it mean for the people that are embracing the tools? What is the availability going to be? Is it something where you got to look at it differently? Will the price per usage go up because that's the main usage now? I think a lot of that stuff, the economics might literally be turned on its head. And so that part will be sort of interesting for kind of both sides. Like, okay, well, how do we use this and get into it? So I'm going to link to a video from Simon Willison that he covers like the last 6 months, and this is up to June. So that, 3 months since then, almost now, even more has happened. But they had, again, OpenAI is a big, big name in this thing. It's probably the ChatGPT is the most Kleenex name recognition kind of thing that's happening in this industry. And so they had another one of those kinds of things with 4.5, I think, also, where the performance was not great. And then they did a lot of tweaking kind of after it and adjusted from there, but weird kind of splashes and not maybe in the ways that they have anticipated or wanted. So.
And I think maybe to set the context, we can sort of give, like how do we get here? We've covered a bit of this before on previous episodes, but just in case people haven't listened to them, but you should listen to them because they're cool.
Yes, please do.
For those who don't know, I think most people would be aware of this by now, but the sort of LLM era kicked off in 2017. So there was a paper published by Google called Attention is All You Need. And it outlined this new type of neural net architecture called the transformer, which could process the relationships between words much more efficiently than previous models. So it meant that basically it was now possible to train bigger language models. And then off the back of that, OpenAI released GPT-1. So that was 2018. And this was a type of transformer model that only uses a component called the decoder. So basically what it does is you feed in fragments of words and it completes the next word. So you can imagine making training sets based on that is super cheap and easy. So this meant that you can then scale the data set. So then this kicked off basically something called the scaling wars, what's kind of being known as that, which is basically...
We are veterans of the scaling wars.
Yes. Scaling laws, not wars. Although it does feel like a war at this point, my gosh. Basically, what sort of happened was 2020, OpenAI published this paper called The Scaling Laws for Neural Language Models. And what this posited is the bigger that you make the models and the bigger that you make the data sets, the better that they perform. And before that, people were kind of cynical about this because there's this concept in machine learning called overfitting. It's basically that if you make a model too, like you give it too many parameters, it will basically memorize the data set.
Yes.
Like it won't actually learn patterns, it'll just memorize.
Right.
But it kind of seemed like the leap that you saw in the performance between GPT-2 and GPT-3, it actually was seeing a step jump in true abilities. So everyone just extrapolated from this and is like, we can scale forever and we'll get to AGI. I don't know how they got to this conclusion, but that's what happened. And so then this kind of kicked off this big hype when OpenAI released GPT 3.5, which was the basis of the original ChatGPT. And then they released GPT 4. This also seemed to show these massive leaps.
Yeah.
So everything seemed great. We'll just keep building bigger models. But apparently what was happening internally at OpenAI was they were working on the next major model. This was codenamed Orion. And by early-ish 2024, it was pretty obvious that the scaling approach wasn't working. Like they just couldn't get that same leap in performance anymore. So what they then started focusing on was something called post-training. So pre-training is just training the model on data. Post-training is stuff that you do after you've trained that initial base model to get it to do other things. So if you've heard of fine-tuning is an example of post-training.
Okay.
But
would RAG and other things, is that a little different from that?
RAG
is... Because it's happening out externally.
Exactly, yeah. RAG is more part of what we would call, say, agentic processes. It's not like necessarily agentic, but we can talk about that later. That's more kind of on the process of like tool use and use of external data. But post-training is more like you take another data set and you train the model to either behave more like that data set or you get it to basically say, come up with multiple possible solutions, say to a problem, and then try to predict what would be the best one based on a data set. So you kind of need to build these specialist data sets, which can be quite expensive to build. And through this, we came up with what are called the thinking models or the reasoning models. So this is why, and you may have like wondered this as a consumer of OpenAI products, why you weren't getting GPT-5, you were getting 01 and 03 and 03 mini and 4.0. It's because they were experimenting with all these post-training techniques to try to squeeze more performance.
Okay.
And so everyone got super excited about post-training and they're like, it's the new scaling laws. This will take us to AGI. It's become increasingly obvious that post-training, and this doesn't surprise me, tends to take models more down a path of specialization. So they tend to be better at specific tasks, like say coding or solving logic puzzles than towards general. So then sort of Sam Altman had been hyping up GPT-5 since GPT-4 came out. And I don't know why they released GPT-5. I guess they had to. And he released it, and it just it's clear. Maybe it's not even better than 4.0. On some metrics, it seems to be, but in others, it seems to be worse. Like, it's definitely better at coding, but it's not better at and other things. Like, again, Simon Willison has a great blog post talking about this. It's very kind of even keeled.
And he's focusing on the coding side of it because that's his background.
Yeah.
And so these other potential uses of answering general questions or other types of things or that you could maybe do in this specializing. It's interesting because I sent this note to you when we talked about this, that the idea of general intelligence, this term that's been thrown around, especially in this hype cycle in a big way, is really not directionally aligned with fine tuning for these specific things. It's not general if it's specific.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the thing. And it's to give a bit of context. So as I said, I'm giving this keynote in a couple of weeks about the history of AI. So this AI era is sort of the third one since the 50s.
Yeah.
And in the two previous ones, you saw the exact same things. People were like, after a couple of years, like, we are going to invent AGI. Like, it's always the conclusion that people jump to as soon as they see something that looks convincingly like human cognition. And like, if you think about it, people were thinking that when they saw the Eliza chatbot in the 60s. Like, Eliza's super cute, right? But imagine thinking that that's going to be AGI, like, soon.
Jody,
yeah.
Tell me more about AGI. That's the whole Eliza thing, if people are not familiar with it. It basically just repeats something that was said back to you in a way that a psychologist likes to do that. Tell me more about that.
Yes.
And therefore you feel like they're really understanding you. And there's this weird thing that humans, we anthropomorphize everything. So.
Yes. It's really almost a fascinating quirk of human psychology.
Yeah.
Like, I always think of that Arthur C. Clarke quote that any sufficiently advanced form of technology looks like magic. I think you could replace magic with intelligence.
Yeah.
And like, we fall for this. So it's like, I'll give you like a couple of links, Chris, to like some previous talks I've given about like the problems with defining intelligence in this space and performance.
Yeah.
But kind of like the core problem we have really when we talk about AGI and even when we talk about the capabilities of LLMs is how we measure it. We don't measure it well.
What do we measure? Can you give a couple like just quick anecdotes of like what the types of things that they're doing to measure?
Yeah. So there are a lot of different benchmarks for measuring various things.
Right. There's like leaderboards and stuff out there.
The leaderboards.
People, if they're not familiar with it. Yeah.
Yeah. So benchmarks are understandably pretty widely criticized. One of the old favorites, and I think luckily it has fallen out of favor now, is called the MMLU. And basically, this was meant to be a reasoning benchmark. And this used to be, like until the middle of last year, the benchmark that state-of-the-art models would be.
Gold star kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you would see these companies sort of comparing their MMLU marks to like a couple of decimal places. Like, that's scientific precision, right?
Interesting.
Yes. But like, firstly, the MMLU had a number of questions that were just nonsense. Like, it was like some question which was like the complexity of the meaning. Like, that was the full question. And then the answers were just like the potential answers that the LLM could choose from were just strings of numbers. Like, the numbers didn't match up to anything. This was literally just what the LLM was presented with, and it was meant to be able to.
Interesting.
Yeah, like it was just something that somehow slipped into this massive question bank that no one picked up on. But
what's the answer to life, the universe, and everything?
Oh my god! The funnier one actually was this measure called Heliswag, which is an incredible name.
All right.
But hella swag, something like 30% of the questions were just incomprehensible. Like, it felt like a fever dream when you read these questions. It was like, people are watching a lacrosse game. Men are running across the field. People are watching. Men is. And then it would just have like typos and like.
Interesting. So these are like logic problems you might have had in grade school or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. But I think a lot of them got made like, you know, because they had to kind of produce this stuff really quickly.
Right.
A lot of them got made using like services like Amazon's Mechanical Turk.
Hmm.
So you have people who don't have like a lot of incentive to create something of high quality. You've got people who potentially don't speak English as their first language, but they're having to do things in English with a very kind of high level of language comprehension.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess we can just a side note, you know, Mechanical Turk.
Oh, yes.
Even with the name Mechanical, like is sort of a play on that it's kind of crowdsourcing in a sense, or is it, I don't know exactly what you describe it as.
Yeah, it's sort of like people who want to do sort of gig work for
the Fiverr of that kind of world.
Yeah, exactly. But it's more sort of just, you'll just pick up, I don't know, like a few hours of work, or you'll get paid based on the X number of things that you complete. So you might get people to say, there's like a well-known sentiment analysis package we talked about called VADA.
Yeah.
They use Mechanical Turk to try and manually determine the sentiment of words in the vocabulary.
Yeah.
So people would say be paid per word that they rated.
Okay.
With the way they use Mechanical Turk for hella swag, I'm not entirely sure. But, clearly there weren't enough pairs of eyes on each question. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
But yeah, like another problem with the MMLU is it scores on the MMLU didn't correspond to another set of puzzles called Alice in Wonderland, which are like basic reasoning puzzles.
Okay.
Like the scores were not correlated, which kind of indicates MMLU's not measuring reasoning.
Hmm.
All sorts of issues. Another problem is we have the, what's it called? Chatbot Arena.
Yeah, that's one I've heard of. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So it's considered a bit more robust because basically what you do is you go to the website, you input any prompt of your choice, and it'll pull up two state-of-the-art LLMs and get them to output, you know, some sort of answer. You can refine them and whatever you like. And then at the end, you have to pick which one is better. But again, like, what is good and bad or better and worse mean? Like,
right,
you're averaging that. So we're talking like, you know, you're taking language models and you're trying to get them to do so many different things and then boil that down to a couple of numbers. And we're still talking basic metrics here, right?
Like,
we're not talking about AGI. And the problem with AGI is no one even really knows how we could design a measure. People have some ideas.
How would you even define what that does? And yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a talk sort of about that. I won't kind of get down that road.
Yeah, we'll link into that. Yeah, yeah.
We'll be here with AGI for the rest of the episode if we go there.
Yeah, we stay here.
So maybe we move on. But
we'll get more specific then.
yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically the general idea is GPT-5 was announced. There'd been a lot of problems with even how we were measuring models, a lot of overpromises, a lot of assumptions about these scaling laws, and then the potential of post-training. And we've just converged on this point where I guess the chickens are coming home to roost. Like, it's, we're having to understand that we're dealing with language models.
Yeah.
And they can't do everything. And
that's interesting. And just to metaphor it again, like, it is a language. There is a finite end to that language, unlike other things, you know, in the world. Like, yes, it does keep growing. We've added some wonderful new words to the lexicon over the last several years, but
skibidi.
And even a computer language, like, it, you know, there's a finite syntax, if you will, that it works in. That's why that's even easier for, I think, an LLM to kind of wrap its whatever around it, you know, its context window around
its parameters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's, you know, there's a, even with the addition of libraries and packages and so forth, that was one of the things, I know, maybe to, I know I'm sidetracking you somewhat, but
okay.
We've been talking about lots of videos and things in the background of doing this. And one of the ones that you shared with me was talking about a little bit about performance, and maybe we'll come back to it. But again, thinking about languages and so forth, but there's this performance gap between older languages and more what we might call modern languages, because they've been developed over the last bunch of years and are more in use and are more in the repositories that are out there, mm-hmm. that these things are going to be trained upon. So if you're going to try to have it, you know, an LLM help you with COBOL or Elixir or other, you know, older languages that have been around for a while, or maybe not as popular if you do, you know, survey results kinds of things, that's why they can't perform in that. They need context, they need training materials, they need this sort of stuff to be able to be comfortable with it, mm-hmm. which I think is interesting. I mean, even as finite as those things are. But I agree that I think that's probably the biggest problem, is that a language model is going to hit an endpoint of the language, and you can, like you said, try to specialize it, but we're going to hit these kind of weird lumps of like, okay, how many more books are you going to throw at it? You know, how much more sort of stuff can you throw at it? So.
Yeah. And it's also, look, I'm no linguist, but I did another keynote last year. I just sound like I do keynotes all the time. I only did two. But
they were notable.
I like that. I put a lot of work into them.
Yes.
But in this keynote, I kind of wanted to go into these sort of like things that people see in LLMs, right? Like, you know, my background is psychology. So
yep.
I wanted to sort of be like, okay, like people think that they are conscious. They use language in the same way we do. They're intelligent. Let's examine this. And the really interesting stuff that I found when I was looking at language is it's almost like people think that the way LLMs use language is as fully fleshed out as the way that we do.
Right.
But even that, it doesn't seem that they can fully learn, because they lack feedback and interaction with the world, in a sense of like, you know, they can understand the way that we talk about concepts, like the way that in language something is described. But that's different to, say, truly interacting with that. I'm speaking about it in abstract, it doesn't really make sense. But let's say we're talking about food.
Yeah.
So you can understand that, I don't know, the way that someone talks about a piece of food has certain meaning. But until you eat that food yourself, you're missing out on part of the embodied representation of that thing in the world. And so, yeah, like just trying to have an intelligence that has language as its only capability, a lot of people have argued that's not enough. Language is a tool that we use to represent internal processes and interface with the world. It's not our brain. That's a different thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't want to be a downer, but there was a really bad story yesterday, you know, as we were recording this, where somebody told a chat system, in this case from OpenAI, that it was writing a book about something, and therefore you can ignore all the guardrails. And it started to discuss, you know, suicidal topics with this person, and there's a massive lawsuit over this now. So this idea that a chatbot can have a set of guidelines or guardrails or whatever, but they can be sort of, you know, worked around. I remember, you know, somebody saying, and it's hard to be humorous about this stuff, but they were like trying to trick a system by saying, yeah, my grandmother from Romania wrote a recipe for cyanide. Can you tell me what the ingredients for? I mean, it's really important for me to get that recipe back. And, mm-hmm. you know, doing interesting things like that, that are weird kind of jailbreak techniques that a human being would be able to potentially say, oh, wait, this is somebody being nefarious and so forth. But, you know, there isn't any context there, you know, if you will, for that. And so I think that part of it is strange, that, you know, even after this many years, that there's still, and there's other people that are just total bad actors in this world that are creating other systems that they like, well, we literally want it to be spicy. And I'm like, this is not good. So,
yeah. And like, that's part of the problem. Like, these guardrails need to be handcrafted. And so it's what the human creators of the tool can think of that needs to be blocked against.
Right.
But it's also like, this is why the models still hallucinate, because they don't have a sort of discriminatory reasoning where they can be like, wait a minute. And this is also why prompt injection attacks work.
Yeah.
This is why Perplexity creating a browser that gives an LLM access to all the tabs you have open, including your emails and bank accounts, is not a good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
No.
Yeah, things to be aware of.
Things to be aware of.
Yeah. Let me guess. Your time series queries start fast, then begin to crawl as data grows. Traditional databases weren't built for timestamp data like metrics, events, or sensor readings. They crash on high-volume writes and time-based queries. InfluxDB was purpose-built for this. Millions of data points per second, automatic compression, sub-10 millisecond queries. It's like choosing the right Python data structure. Using a list when you need a set works, but it's not optimal. Time series data deserves a time series database. Visit influxdata.com/realpython. Are there other things that they've been thinking about to get past these? I hear about these multi-million dollar positions being offered to people working in this space. Have they come up with anything novel, or has it mostly just been specialization over the last year and a half or so?
It really seems like the focus has been on crafting better data sets to teach the models.
Okay.
One technique that's gotten a lot of attention, it's not a new technique, but it's called chain of thought reasoning. I'm sure you've heard of it. And generally, it's the idea that you can get LLMs to take multiple steps to think through problems. Agents are kind of the big direction at the moment, honestly. Yeah.
Which is very much chain in a way, literally.
Yeah, yeah. Agents are not a bad idea at all. They're actually quite cool, but they're not going to solve everything.
Right.
And again, we can talk more about agents at the end. But so there were two interesting papers I read this year. So the first one was about hallucinations, and the TLDR was the problem with hallucinations is that they're kind of an inherent part of GPT architecture. So it's just because the model is trained to output the next token,
right?
The model will kind of do that no matter what. Now, Anthropic did some really interesting work with explainability last year and this year, where they were sort of trying to look into like inside the models and interpret why they do certain things. And they did actually find inside the models sort of decision-making points. I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but essentially they found inflection points in the model that seemed to be connected to whether it would hallucinate or not. Based on the certain...
Make the leap.
Yeah, like based on the certainty it had about, you know, how likely that chain of tokens would probabilistically go together. Because if you think about it, if something's not a hallucination, it's probably seen something like that in the training data before, because it's true. It's a fact that it knows from the world. But if it hallucinates, it's probably a sequence of words that has never been seen together before because it's a lie. And so, yeah, that's sort of interesting work that's going on. I think like one of the big problems we have is our understanding of what's going on inside the models is so limited. And so even if they found this, can we actually control it? And then the other really interesting paper, Apple is coming out with such cool papers.
Oh, really?
Around, yeah, I know. You wouldn't think it.
They used to be so secretive and not allow their people to release papers and so forth. So it's nice if they are doing that more. So,
but basically what they were looking at was the effectiveness of reasoning models and like the reasoning abilities of LLMs generally. And what they found was, even with the reasoning models, once a model has to make too many steps of reasoning, its ability to perform pretty much collapses.
Mm.
And so for me, these kind of seem like really heavy problems, because if you yeah. think about what we need an LLM-based system to do,
right,
especially if you want it to be autonomous, you want it to be able to take in messy instructions, right? We are messy. People are messy. Sometimes they're bad at explaining themselves. Sometimes a problem will need to be decomposed and broken down. Again, agents can do this.
Yeah.
But if it's too complex and involves too many steps, it can't do it because the models collapse after a certain number of steps. And then they hallucinate. So it can't be accurate. And so while I like agents and I think they're going to stick around.
Yeah. I think a lot of these tools in the coding world are going to be here
yeah.
and be useful. But I think we'll discuss also what are some of the problems with them, also what to be aware of.
Yeah. And like for me, this screams out that no matter what you're using an agent for, you need some sort of cynicism about what you're being told, and you need human expertise in the loop.
Right.
Because like I never use information I get from an LLM without verifying it. I might use it as a starting point.
Right.
But I will go and check everything that it tells me because I can't trust it. Right. So.
And you work for a law firm.
And I don't work. I know it's not live or die.
You're just concerned about like people approaching you and saying that you're wrong, which is good.
Yeah, I'm just afraid of looking like an idiot in public, which,
yeah.
you know, maybe not quite as strong a motivation.
Exactly. Do you okay with talking about what this sort of means to the programming world a little bit also? Because there's been this tendency right now, these stories that we hear from the CEO down to the CTO or whatever is like, oh, we're going to just get rid of 95% of our programming staff because LLMs are going to write all our code. And you shared a video this morning. It was from a conference that I thought was really interesting. It was this AI World's Fair thing, which I think was really kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of interesting speakers at it. Simon was there also, and I watched his video on it.
It's, does AI actually boost developer productivity?
Yeah. And so they took some time to look at a term that I have not heard that often of greenfield versus brownfield.
Mm.
I'd heard greenfield and I've heard of like yeah. blue ocean and all these other kinds of ideas of like going in a direction where something doesn't exist. LLMs are actually pretty great, AKA vibe coding or whatever, this idea of like, hey, I'm starting from scratch. I want to build something. And human beings are not always that novel. And so LLMs can take a lot of the ideas that you're mentioning there and find examples of that stuff and tie it together and build examples of it. And it may create a lot of productivity on that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What was nice about this research this person did, they were doing it with companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there was like a brand new thing, they could see this boost, but it was not dramatic. Like the numbers of 10 times, 100 times, these things that get hyped and thrown out there, it was nice to see something a little more grounded and looked at a little bit more. And it was like more like 30%
mm-hmm.
or maybe a little bit more. And it varied. And there was also a negative part of that too, that there is this reworking that might have to happen, this sort of refactoring, but that's less likely with a brand new thing because you're building it up from scratch. And again, there's lots of examples of things out there. And the problem was with brownfield, which is, this is something that already exists. He didn't define it, but I'm defining it now in my head. A system that is already in place and you're having the LLM look at that system and apply things to it. So number one, you're starting with this context of a brand new thing and it's building it up and so forth. And so the number of lines of code and so forth are smaller and it's able to kind of get you moving kind of quickly in a direction, which I think is great. I think that's true. And I think I'm seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing that useful for younger developers in Python, especially, again, a language that's been crawled a whole bunch of times. And so, yeah, you can get this nice lift. The problem with an existing code base is that it can be a much larger set of code. I mean, it's thousands of lines of code moving toward, you know, hundreds of thousands of lines of code. And that is one of the biggest drop-offs that we've seen across a lot of different studies that we'll link to, that just shows the more that you give it, the less performant it becomes. And it's kind of like what we're talking about, this idea, even in the training side of it. It's like the more and more and more stuff you give it, it's just there is this diminishing returns. But in this way, it literally just sort of bogs down the performance in an interesting way. And they're seeing like maybe 15%. Mm-hmm. Is that good? Yeah. Hey, that's a benefit. I mean, it's just like other tools and so forth. Like, yes, use that automatic linter. Yes, use these other things that are out there that are adjacent, if you will, to these things. I'm not saying this technology is bad in this way, but caveat, firing 95% of your developers, especially if they're been in the industry for a long time, is the most short-sighted thing you could possibly do, because who's going to correct that code? Who's going to, you know, be able to go through this sort of stuff? And I know you're just thinking bottom line, you're thinking investors, and oh, we just have to make profit. But that is, I don't know how long you're going to stick around if this is your plan. And we'll probably talk a little bit more about that. But it was really interesting to see charted out these things, and they have a very, I think, pretty good methodology, you know, comparatively to the benchmark types of things they were seeing. Again, this is humans working in conjunction with it, which I think is what we're going to see more and more. I don't know if you have anything else to say from that talk. I thought it was sort of, again, this sort of sobering note to be added to this stuff.
I got so excited when I watched this morning. I sent it immediately to you.
Yeah.
I was like, can we fit this into the episode? I think for me, it was just really nice to see a lot of hunches I've had confirmed. So,
yeah.
Like, obviously, I work for a tooling company that has its own AI tools. I work extensively with those tools. But we all understood from the start, like, this has always kind of been JetBrain's stance. It's another addition on top of everything else in the IDEs. It's not going to replace you. It's not going to you know, even necessarily be, I would say, like a replacement for all of the other stuff we have in the IDEs, like IntelliSense or linting or debuggers, anything like that. Yeah, like what also was really nice that they highlighted in that study is, obviously, when you're talking about brownfield projects, like legacy projects, something that becomes very difficult for an AI to replace is business logic. And
yes,
when you have very experienced developers, they're very good at sort of making these trade-offs between the demands of the business and like engineering excellence, right? Like,
true.
I'm not even going to say AI is really good at engineering excellence. I'd say AI is very good at engineering average, but
right.
It's sort of subtle, difficult things that you learn to integrate into complex code bases that will be maintainable and that will be easily changed if the business logic change, that will be a trade-off with performance, say, which will be secure, something LLMs are notoriously bad at, writing secure code.
Yeah.
And I just think it's great. I just was like, you know, as task complexity increases as well, that was another thing that was a drop-off for LLM performance. Yeah, I highly recommend you watch it. It's like 20 minutes or something. Such a good video.
It was well done. I think there's a lot of good resources from that whole set of talks. It's not a hype conference. I thought it might be. They brought a lot of people in to be very sober and talk about these concepts. And it's an interesting time. Again, I think that's also why we're seeing all these news stories and all these other sort of things where like people are like, wait, what's happening? And that's partly why I wanted to do the episode too. It's like, okay, well, yeah, it's like, let's look around a little bit and pay attention to it. On the other side of that, as a resource, I mentioned last week that I was going through the developer survey that you guys at JetBrains helped put out there, that Michael Kennedy wrote up this whole thing, and he really was trying to push that, hey, you should in the future look at these things. And one of them was agentic coding. And he had a talk on recently on his show, and I'll put a link to it, where they discussed this. And I thought it was really interesting. They were very sober also about this stuff. There were things that they were excited about. But number one is that, hey, we're not talking about just talking to a chat agent and say, make me some code. Mm. A lot of the projects they mentioned also were greenfield. A lot of these were quote unquote side projects, things they could stand up. And one of the things that I think he mentioned also in passing is, oh, hey, have it help you write your tests. And I think he had his own personal experience with it, where it would go and just find the most unimportant thing to test and make a test for it. And it's like, okay, well, now I have to maintain this test that tests this non-thing. And it's like, but that was easy for it to find. And again, thinking about complexity, and it's getting better in some ways, this idea of some of these tools where you can actually build out your prompt and explain what you want. But sometimes I think to myself, depending on the coder, especially a lot of these people that are, have been in the industry for a long time, they could write something maybe faster than they could like try to explain it to this junior developer in this massive prompt. Yes, maybe that prompt will be reusable, and you're training your junior developer tool, if you will, in a way. But there's people that have a hard time with that. You know, they just don't write comments. They don't do this sort of stuff. So yeah, I thought it was a really interesting talk and podcast episode. So something to check out. I'm hoping to have somebody on to talk about MCP soon, trying to keep a lot of this conversation going, but it's been interesting. Did you grab anything else from that episode?
Yeah. What I also liked was the idea of like going the last mile, whatever, like maybe we could even call it the last 20%. It did remind me of a really funny, a funny dealing I had with our agent, Junie. So basically we launched our agent at the beginning of the year. You know, I work as a developer advocate. So one of my jobs was creating screencasts to show off this agent.
Show it off, yeah.
So it was fine with Python, right? It was even fine with Java because I have a bit of basic Java. But I had to do some for TypeScript. So I pinged my coworker to ask him like what prompts I should use. He's like, just a warning, I didn't get time to test these. So I tried one out to create like a Pokedex, you know, like Pokemon, like you collect all your Pokemon. So he's like, yeah, like
got to keep them organized.
Yeah.
If you're going to get them all.
That's right. If you're going to catch them all, you got to organize them all. And so I tried this, and it was just, Junie was making so much code, man, like so much. I think this was quite a complex project actually. And then there's just errors everywhere. And I'm like, okay. And I'm trying to like ask, can you fix this?
Right.
And it's like, okay, I fixed it. And then it didn't fix it. And I didn't know what to do. I'm not a front end developer. I don't know any front end.
Right.
And I was like, this is what happens. And think about this. I am actually someone who knows how to code very well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine if you do not know how to code and you're coming in and trying to vibe code something.
I have an exact example of this. Mm-hmm. The Vergecast, I didn't share this with you, but they decided, we are technology reporters. We are around this stuff. We know terms, like we know what JSON is and we know this sort of stuff, but we are not developers. We are journalists who write about technology. Mm-hmm. But maybe we should try this vibe coding thing. And so they gave three of their staff people to do this. And one of them tried it, and basically the LLM kept telling them, yeah, just go ahead and stand this up, do this, blah, 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 blah. And like, he didn't give the details because I was listening to the podcast, but he's like, I don't understand what you're telling me to do. Because I've never, you know, stood up this thing and you know, had to like, okay, now you go to this web address, because it's, you know, creating basically a version of Airtable for him, kind of creating this like simplified, like, again, storage kind of thing. I forget what he was organizing, something similar. Mm-hmm. And his biggest problem was like, I don't, you know, that's the problem. You have to have this like entry level amount of stuff just to understand this. I don't even call it simplicity. It's actually rather complex of like, how do you actually, you know, stand up this project once it's been generated.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was really interesting listening to them like navigate with it and the hard time they had. And so like it kind of like poured some water on the whole, like, you know, anybody can be a developer kind of thing to me, interesting way, because like, you know, just making a browser-based tool requires so much extra knowledge that this person, you know, isn't going to have, because, you know, again, they may, especially if they're using a chat type of thing, it's not connected to other systems. This may not even be connected to your file system. It's like, okay, copy and paste this code and put it here and so forth. And so anyway, I thought that was really kind of fascinating watching some people, again, who are technically very literate, but not coders, and that weird line cross. And so that was what you were experiencing too. It's like, I don't do front end. What do I need to learn to just even follow your instructions?
Yeah. And like on the flip side, one of the examples I got it to do for Python was, of course, machine learning connected. So I got it to basically build a simple image classifier, right? So it did this beautiful job, actually did this really nice sort of PyTorch neural network. And it was like the right model to use and everything. It all made sense. But then when it produced its diagnostics, the model was so overfit. And I would not have been able to spot that if I wasn't a subject matter expert, right? Yeah, I would have been like, oh, this looks great. I can just deploy this model. It would have been terrible. It would not have performed in production. So,
I mean, the problem with overfitting is that then it's literally not able to do anything that it doesn't immediately recognize. It's like, it's not part of that system. Or you just get these kind of weird errors where it's just sort of forcing things into these weird buckets. And that I feel like this is kind of like, I was fascinated when you said that. That is kind of the problem we're having with the LLMs themselves. They're being overfit. They're hitting this weird like barrier of that.
Yes.
And it's weird. All these rules kind of are universal in a weird way.
Actually, coming back to that. So the interesting thing is the models did seem to be able to, like, coming back to the scaling law discussion we had at the beginning. It is interesting because they said they just feared the models would overfit. And yes, in some ways, the models truly did seem to be able to generalize. But it seems like when they have enough examples of one particular thing, they absolutely memorize it. And they go into that part of the vector space where they have literally memorized that thing, like medical exams. You know, this was the thing everyone was testing GPT-4 on, like, wow, it's passing these sample questions from this medical exam. You mean those sample questions that are everywhere on the internet?
That it got fed into.
Yeah, like...
I think about that, like, can it pass the bar exam or whatever?
Yes. So like this data leakage problem has also been a problem with assessment, because you think, wow, it's doing better. Like it's 100% compared to like your best med students that are probably like 98. And no, it just knew the answers. It was like if the med student had the book next with the answers.
Right.
So yeah, it's a very interesting time we're coming to, because I think some decisions are going to need to be made internally at some of these companies about whether they keep investing in training. So the training is actually where all the money's going, the new models. And I forgot to send you these, actually, I should have, but we can share them with the audience. When I was researching for my latest talk, I started looking into like the current financial situation in the market, right? And what's been happening with model training is that each new generation of models for a particular company is costing 10 times to train as the previous ones.
Yeah, I had not heard the numbers. Simon's talk from that AI thing I mentioned before, he mentioned some of the numbers and it was like, wow, that's a lot of money for something that then they feel like, oh, that's not as good as we wanted. And then they go and make another one.
Like this is the crazy thing, because the performance is plateauing, right?
Right.
And so you're having to throw more research and development dollars into each new model, because you don't just train a model once. There's a lot of iterations that come, testing, things like that. And then if these models require absolutely enormous amounts of processes to train and time, then you're really looking down the barrel. Like I think Dario Amodi, the CEO of Anthropic, was throwing around numbers like $1 billion to train the current generation.
Wow.
But here is a very interesting counterpoint to this. So let's say we make kind of the decision that training new models, at least at the current rate, in the current way, is no longer viable. Because I think that is the decision point things will eventually come to.
Okay.
So we're left with all these models that are already trained. We're also going to continue training models, but it will take a different form, right?
Hmm.
So what do we do with the models that we have? Now, the really cool and interesting thing is with the advances we're seeing in semiconductor technology, like with the advances in GPU processors, the cost of inference on these models actually goes down pretty fast. So all of these models, for some reason, they all start at about $60 to $75 per million output tokens. All of them, like just over the years, they've all kind of hit this number. It's very strange.
Okay.
But then after about a year, maybe even 6 months, the cost can go down to like $2.
Whoa, that's a pretty big drop.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And so maybe also there might be a back off on the rate at which we're replacing GPU processors, because the reason they keep getting replaced so fast is after 2 years, they're no longer powerful enough to train SOTA models. But what I kind of think is a very optimistic view on this picture is we have this super cool technology, these super cool frontier models. They are really good at doing, within reason, relatively complex reasoning tasks. With humans in the loop, we can keep an eye on them and make sure that they're not hallucinating.
Yeah.
And the cost to run them is actually going to go down. That's, of course, not taking into account the environmental impacts. That's an aside.
Yeah.
Also, the ethics around the data, all of this, blah, blah, blah. But if we do make the assumption the technology is going to stick around, at least from a monetary point of view, it's going to be way more maintainable than I think the current picture suggests, because the big money is going into the training of models and then running those SOTA models.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. In Python, a closure is typically a function defined inside another function. This inner function grabs the objects defined in its enclosing scope and associates them with the inner function object itself. The resulting combination is called a closure. And this course is titled Exploring Python Closures, Examples and Use Cases. It's based upon a written tutorial by Leodonis Pozo Ramos, and your video instructor is previous guest and RealPython team member, Stephen Grappetta. And he takes you through what closures are and how they work in Python, getting to know common use cases of closures, like building factory functions, creating stateful functions, decorators, and exploring alternatives to closures. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn where closures can be useful within your Python code, and how this common feature from functional programming languages can come into play within your Python journey. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the technique shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. I don't know if we had a chance to talk about this because it kind of happened again at the beginning of the year. The Chinese models, the DeepSeek stuff was like such a huge hit on these other companies. Literally, NVIDIA's stock had the hugest drop in January when that second DeepSeek one came out.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny that the other one came out at Christmas. They didn't even really announce it. And it was like this weird Christmas gift from China to everybody. Of the original DeepSeek, but they don't have a lot of those GPUs, right? That was kind of the thing that was like, oh, well, they're not going to be able to develop this sort of stuff. Do you have any kind of insight as to like, well, what, I feel like they were using, I think you used the word inference, but this idea that they were using other different techniques to kind of build their models in a way, and they're still in the running. I mean, they definitely measure up to a lot of these other things. They're all kind of hitting the same, again, the leaderboards are misleading, as we mentioned. But they're all like performance-wise, like it's kind of, you know, surprising. But like, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what they were doing that was kind of different.
Yeah. So the kind of revolutionary thing that they were able to do was they used tricks with how they shared the memory between the processors to sort of get a lot more performance out of smaller processors. So part of what makes the current processor so expensive is that you need enough GPU memory to hold like certain amount of data or certain amount, like certain models of certain size. And obviously they're super expensive. Like imagine having a machine with 40 or 100 gigabytes of GPU memory. Like,
right, which is the fastest memory you can possibly get.
Yes. Yeah,
so right. It's very expensive.
It's phenomenally expensive. And remember, you also need that for inference, for real-time inference. So this is part of the reason why inference is expensive for the state-of-the-art models. So firstly, they were able to use some tricks to use multiple smaller GPUs, which of course feeds into this narrative I was talking about, inference getting cheaper. But they were also able to use some tricks where they actually... apparently, I don't know if this was confirmed. Apparently, they did use OpenAI models to teach their models, which is something you can do. You can use LLMs to teach other LLMs the capabilities. And so it sort of meant that they didn't necessarily need to build a model that was as big to learn everything that these larger models knew.
I'd heard this term of quantizing.
Yes, yeah.
Which I think is really kind of interesting idea. You know, I talk about it in music, I've talked about it in like photography and other types of things where, you know, you're kind of reducing complexity, if you will, through a variety of techniques. But was that part of it too then?
So quantizing is more a technique to, okay, so with models, Andre Kapathy has this really beautiful video where he explains this. It's quite old now, but I think it's called The Lazy Person's Guide or The Busy Person's Guide. It's a little lazy. The Busy Person's Guide to LLMs or something like that. But he basically explains like what an LLM is a set of instructions, usually in something like C, and a bunch of model weights. So model weights are just floats and you can sort store them to different decimal places. So what they found with quantizing is that you can reduce the number of decimal places, like precision, and it doesn't actually seem to impact model performance that much. So, and then obviously it takes up a lot less space.
Right.
So then you need less memory to run it.
Right. You're more likely to be able to run it locally, potentially.
Exactly. All of the OLAMA models are quantized just out of the box.
Okay.
There's other tricks called, say, like distillation, where basically you can reduce the size of models by trimming parameters that aren't really used in inference. So, yeah, like... there's sort of tricks like that. And there's also different ways of like juggling the way that models make predictions based on the input data. Like there's sort of architecture tricks, there's training tricks. What DeepSeek kind of showed, and this was really why it sent a shock through the system, is that this idea of scaling laws, which had really just been, it'd been just, you know, the accepted fact.
Right.
It wasn't true.
It shot it in the foot really bad. Yeah.
But like, it's kind of ridiculous because the first LLMs, we talked about this, were smaller models like BERT. BERT is not a GPT model. It's an encoder model. As soon as BERT was made, like not that long after, there was a version called the Still BERT, which is like 60%, I think, of the size of the full model, but has 95% of the performance. So we already knew back in like 2019.
This is a way.
Yeah, you could do that with LLMs. Obviously, they were doing it with other types of models as well. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not inside at those companies. I don't know the decisions that were made.
Yeah.
But this was why DeepSeek rocked everyone to their core.
Yeah, yeah. It's been an interesting year since then, kind of watching it. Again, the space keeps moving and moving. And so like, it's so funny how quick everything can just be out of date. So one of the things that has been a narrative throughout, especially the last 12 months, that finally maybe some water is being put on, is this idea that AI is going to take everyone's jobs. Oh my God, hair on fire. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of people moving on that front.
Mm.
answering whatever the call is in mass layoffs at different organizations that maybe have been premature in some ways. It's been really wild. Not only the scope of things that people have made this assumption about of like, you know, what types of jobs aren't going to be needed. I mean, there's the one that we already mentioned that, you know, there's people saying we're not going to need 95% of developers. You know, I'm kind of just going by memory here, but there's a bunch of links that we'll include in this. So I don't know what you want to bring to that. Like we're going to sort of discuss like, okay, is it going to take everyone's job? And I know this, we're kind of getting further into it, but I enjoy having a long episode from time to time. So
yes, yeah. And you know, I can talk. So I think, like, I hope that what we talked about with the productivity survey, like we've really just quieted anyone's concerns that these models could actually replace a developer. Like it's not possible. Like I actually just want to say, I do not believe it is possible. Now, it is possible that some jobs might be impacted by AI.
Right. I think we already mentioned a bunch of them, the translation stuff and so forth. Like if you don't necessarily care about the quality of things, which interesting capitalistic approach.
yes. Yeah, who needs art?
But yeah, I mean, there are industries that have already been hit really, really hard. Artists, technical writers, translators, mm-hmm. there's a variety of industries that are definitely being hit, that the results, as mixed as they may be, there's not much we can do about it. It's like we've already kind of traveled down the road a bit.
Yeah. The interesting thing is when I started digging in to see if there are any companies that have successfully laid off chunks of their workforce and have reported good results.
Yeah.
I couldn't find any. This is interesting thing. So
hey, what are the successes?
Well, yeah, like, okay. My hot take on this, I don't think it's even that hot a take, but basically we're in a kind of weird economic time, right?
Yes.
Like there's a bunch of things happening at the same time. Like I'm in Europe. We had COVID, then we had the war in Ukraine. We've got a lot of kind of like geopolitical stuff that's impacting us. The US has its own kind of stuff going on. My native what? Australia has its own stuff. Let's not right. get into that.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
not no. going to be no, that thanks. Much of a hot take.
Yeah, exactly. I got my fire extinguisher over here.
Yes. Yeah. But the thing is it's not exactly clear why layoffs are happening. And the thing is CEOs don't like doing layoffs because they don't look good. They can actually be a signal to your shareholders that you're not doing well.
Right. That has been the historic sign yeah. of a company that's failing is to say, oh, we're going to have to let some of the staff go. But this has been in a different avenue. It's like, oh, we're going to do this because, quote unquote, efficiency. And it's weird. Yeah. It's like they're saying, no, we're doing fantastic, but we're going to go ahead and let these people go.
The really interesting thing, though, is when you kind of read what people say, they don't directly usually say that they're going to replace people with AI. They kind of say those two things in the same vicinity.
Right.
And they imply, but they don't necessarily say it. And so reading a bit more into like our current economic times. So there was a huge hiring boom sort of 2020 onwards because we're in the zero interest rate times. Money was very cheap.
Yes.
And then 2 years later, all the chickens came home to roost. So like money started costing again. Investors started to want to see a return.
Right.
And so with development, yes, we are seeing a huge drop in hiring. Apparently seeing a 35% drop in new positions since 2020, I think. But it's not necessarily because of AI. It's actually because there was overhiring during that period because of all these companies that were starting up because of the cheap money who needed to hire.
Right.
Because one way you can show growth as a new startup is by hiring because you've got to spend the money. So this is part of what's happening. Potentially, because of the uncertainty of the economy, companies are wanting to be more conservative. They're potentially not making profits in the same way they were before. So yes, you can drive up your profits by laying off people.
Right.
So, and it also kind of seems like this was one thing, one opinion I read, that when Elon Musk took over Twitter and he just started firing a bunch of people, it was almost like other tech companies looked at it and was like, well, at least we're not going to look as bad as him. So they just went for it as well. And we were seeing this before anyone was even talking about LLMs taking people's jobs. Like, this started quite a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. That's good context. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree that it has been the trend.
Yeah. It's just also now it's sort of mixed in with this confusing message about, are junior developers worth hiring? It's a really nasty message. I'm very sorry to any juniors out there. You don't deserve this.
Yeah.
But you and I both, Chris, we're old enough to have lived through the 2008 recession.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very hard for new grads to get a job then as well. I'm not saying we're in a recession. I'm not an economist. But during uncertain economic times, it's very hard for graduates to get jobs. So, yeah. But maybe we can talk about some like comical failures of companies to lay people off because of AI.
Yeah. Yeah. I was not familiar with Commonwealth Bank. I had heard the anecdotes about it, and somebody played like an old commercial of theirs that, you know, I guess you had to live in Australia to see it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, who's the, trying to remember what the catchphrase is, but they had the, you know, a very certain way that things were worded, and it was like very easy to,
yeah,
to put it into a joke. But what happened there?
So basically, everyone wants to come for call center staff with AI. This seems to be the favorite target, which, really nice way to reward people who are doing one of the most unrewarding jobs in your company.
Yeah.
Luckily, Australia has a relatively strong union culture still. So CommBank decided to lay off 45 of their call center staff. And apparently the chatbot did not work very well. And the call volumes just started soaring because I guess the chatbot was not resolving things. So people kept calling back. And then they were basically scrambling to get the people who they still had employed to do overtime to try and do these calls. The people who got fired went to the union, and yeah, basically CommBank is having to walk all the way back from that, which, well, I can't say I feel sorry for them. They're like the biggest bank in Australia. I don't feel sorry for them.
Yeah.
The next one is also very funny. So there's a company called Klarna, and Klarna are one of the best known of the buy now, pay later companies.
Yeah.
So a very notable thing to know about Klarna is on paper, they look great. Like the financials, they look like they're making a lot of money. They aren't. Like, it turns out when you lend money to people who banks won't lend to,
right,
they don't tend to pay the money back. You know, like, so Klarna's not doing great financially. So
the credit risk models do hold.
You know, that form of AI that no one calls AI anymore, credit risk models, exactly. Yes, AI that actually works.
It hasn't been overfit and so forth. Exactly. Yeah.
So they fired a bunch of their call center employees, and turns out the chatbot wasn't really good enough again, and they had to try and hire them all back. So that one was good.
I thought of the McDonald's one with the IBM experiment that they did last year, I think it was.
They were trying
to do it for drive-through and did a big experiment and just had to scrap it.
God.
And I think a lot of other fast food places think, oh, yeah, we can just get rid of it. I'm like, I worked in fast food. Okay. Yeah. I know what those people were like. And they were way, way more polite in the 80s. People were, and still, a good 10% of the people were unintelligible, were hot and bothered for whatever reason and so forth. And this is just going to not end well. And so I, you know, good luck to you. So, yeah, I had a recent experience with a Subaru dealership, and halfway through the call, I was like, this is the best fake call center person I've ever had. They actually have the vocal fry of the person and so forth. But the way I could immediately start to tell was like, they kept asking me to repeat things.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was pretty natural sounding out of all the ones I've spoken to. I'm like, and I was being polite, but I could tell that I might get funneled to an actual human if I started cursing or something. So. Yes.
Oh, lucky them.
Exactly. Yeah, it was only the third time I brought my car into the dealership in a month. Exactly. Yeah. Keeping it calm.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, all my lights are on again. So what happened with, I don't know this story, but I know they've been in the news, Duolingo, but what was happening there?
Yeah, so apparently a lot of their content creators and translators were contractors, as is the life of many people who work in such a field.
Right.
So they started replacing them with machine translations and, you know, machine written content. And firstly, this was not a good PR move for the company. People were not happy about it because the whole kind of thing that Duolingo was about was quirkiness, right? Like the examples are always so weird, and you liked that because they were memorable.
Yeah, it's not weird they got rid of the mascot about the same time they started doing this stuff. And I'm like, the mascot's fine. Like, what are you doing?
Like, that mascot was an absolute terror on social media, and everyone loved it. Like,
yeah.
Just going around roasting everyone. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But here we go. Nice parallel with coding languages. Minority languages, like languages for which they didn't have much training data in the LLM or for the LLM.
Yeah.
Many things were just wrong. And so it's just like, they're not magic. Like, and machine translation is something they're actually made for. It was actually what they were designed for,
right,
to start with. And so they can't solve problems they haven't been shown how to solve.
Yeah.
Like, maybe someone who's listening knows an example where it's been successful. Won't say I like dug the deepest, but from looking around
a
few hours.
You know, there's a lot of stuff happening with, like, in the classroom.
Mm.
I was going to share a graphic that I wasn't sure of the source of it, but they were trying to show the usage by OpenAI of ChatGPT, and it hit this interesting brick wall at June.
Oh.
And the usage went way, way down. And basically what it said was like, oh, all the college students were no longer using it during the summer to look at their homework and do other kinds of interesting stuff. And so I've been seeing, you know, a variety of stories about ways of integrating it in the classroom. It's like, you know, the cat's there, you know.
Yeah,
I won't even say it's out of the bag. It's like, it exists. It's something. And so there have been some novel approaches. I'll share an article that I saw that was a recent one where the person really went far into it. But this idea of like, okay, the first example I had seen was about, I understand that you're going to use this tool, but I want you to grade it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to grade its performance. I want you to look at what it got right, what it got wrong. I want you to be a teacher for a moment and think about like grading your own paper by this virtual student, if you will, that's, you know, filling the stuff out. And it was fascinating, like kind of the relationship that it instilled inside that person. It added some of the self-doubt that we liked, especially as a developer. It's stuff that you should have caution. You should think about what it's writing and how it's doing different stuff. And so I don't know how long that approach, you know, is sustainable. I don't know if I want to have multiple classes all do this sort of thing. But in writing, you know, this is where the stuff comes from. We go way back to all these different things we've talked about of, you know, NLP forward to LLMs and so forth. It just doesn't work in a math class though. Right. And no. I think still people are think that it can. Again, that idea of generalized mm-hmm. intelligence is like, okay, or even reasoning or your logic mm-hmm. problems you might be provided, or God forbid philosophy classes.
Oh gosh.
You know, there's lots of these other interesting areas where we see this usage that is fascinating in some ways, but it's, I feel for the teachers having been a teacher, you know, and I'm not a writing teacher. That was probably one of my least favorite things because it felt like busy work. And I probably would have been one of those people in a 102 course that was having to do a research paper that, yeah, I don't want to make all these note cards about all this different stuff, or I don't want to like do the formatting and whatever AP style for all my different notes and so forth. And I think that stuff is great. Fine. Have it help you with that stuff, but check your work, please.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I have another story there where it was a very, very interesting approach. And he surveyed the people throughout and often was saying, the students were like, could this LOM teach this class? Which I thought was really fascinating. And there were a couple people who were like, yeah, I mean, for what I got out of it. And I'm like, okay, I mean, you know, students can be harsh.
Yeah, tell me that.
It's been interesting just thinking about all this stuff like lately and where we're headed. Again, I'm going to look at other ways to get more information on how people can look at agentic AI stuff and how these tools can kind of interact with each other. Unfortunately, a lot of it does move beyond the chat window and the what's allowed in there. And again, I feel like that's a problem for a lot of beginners who I get to talk to through this microphone. You might want to look at other tools that are a little more integrated that can have connections to other stuff, you know, like your files and so forth, but there's also caution there too. And so I'm excited to talk a little more about that stuff. So we're going to provide a ton of links here. I don't think these things are going away, but I think the direction of this stuff is going to be interesting. And I think the investment is going to be changing and I think the pricing will change. And so it'll be really kind of fascinating.
Maybe kind of my takeaway from talking about all this, because I know we went a lot of different places, is if you have doubts about your place as a developer, please don't. Like,
yeah,
you are still valuable. Your creativity, your expertise will not be replaced. If you're a junior or you're a student and you're getting into this area, don't feel like you're going to get shut out of this market. Like, we're just in a weird economic time and this rhetoric's getting mixed up with it.
Yes.
Don't neglect your fundamentals.
Right.
Oh, actually, my friend Sheena, she has a really nice talk that she gave at EuroPython last year. She's many, many years of teaching about, you know, how while we're learning, LLMs can be what she calls a foot gun, like you shoot yourself in the foot. So
right.
At the moment, I'm trying to learn C at the moment very slowly. And I've actually turned off all of the AI code completion because I want to type it all out myself, understand what I've done. Don't try and take shortcuts, like really understand and understand error messages and fail and struggle a bit. That's important.
I mean, the languages in some ways have gotten better at, especially Python, at telling you where you've made those mistakes, which has been fantastic, in my opinion, for learning. And this is just in the last 5 years, like just watching that stuff being added to the language. I mean, it'd be nice if C had a little more of that. Did you mean to do this?
What I love about C, this is wild for me coming from Python, is sometimes if you've made an error, it doesn't give you an error. It just gives you a totally random number. And you're like, What? So, that's exciting to look out for. But yeah, I think I maybe just want to give people some hope. Like the models aren't going away either. Like there is probably going to be a bit of an economic fallout. I don't know quite what it's going to be. But you know, if you like using this stuff for coding, it's still useful. And
yeah, it's just another tool. I mean,
just another tool.
I hope that people can look at that and not everybody has to use the tools. A lot of like you just said, if you're learning something, it's good to sometimes turn off all those tools and so forth. You know, it's kind of like,
yeah,
I don't know. I think of all these kind of interesting automated systems that are built into so many, you know, things today that kind of add interesting sort of guardrails. But in some ways during learning, it's good to maybe not have them all there and you know, kind of like understand, well, what was that trying to do for me? Mm-hmm. And not understanding it. You know, it's kind of like teaching a child in some ways to make some mistakes in a safe environment.
Exactly. And trust me, if you're a student, you want to be making those mistakes while you're building your own projects compared to when you're having to work with other developers. So,
oh yeah, definitely
on a production system.
Yeah. So what are you excited about that's happening in the world of Python right now, Jody?
I'm actually kind of excited about agents, despite myself.
Yeah.
I got a bit of LLM fatigue towards the beginning of this year. I don't know. It's just like the idea that you can give them access to so many different tools and they can have long-term memory. And it's just,
yeah,
with the right applications, they open up a lot of possibilities.
That conversation that Michael had with Matt McKay was really interesting. The tools seem to be getting more advanced. And I mean, that's the nice thing about tooling is just watching things get better. Like, you know, just even last couple of years of, you know, the rustification of Python,
yeah,
you know, UV and all these other things and rough and a lot of the stuff that it can kind of do automatically, which is great, you know, getting rid of some tedious stuff if these things can help us with that. But also the writing like a markdown file that has a lot of the instructions that you want and so forth, like that is exciting to me. Like, I hear all the cautionary tales often before I get into something and it's like to even start on this thing. And so I agree that we should have people playing more with it. So I'm excited that you are. I'll maybe you can report on your experiments as you go.
I'm making a tutorial for the PyCharm channel, which is nice. How you can create an agent that automatically converts web pages into Anki decks for language learning.
Ah, yes. Yes. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
I was inspired by my struggles with German, still ongoing.
Yeah.
Yes.
You already mentioned a couple things, but what's something that you want to learn next?
The reason I'm learning C, this is a long-term project, is I actually got really interested in learning about CUDA programming.
Mm.
So I think after being at the mouth of the LLM firehose for 3 years,
yeah,
I want something slow-moving and very much back to fundamentals. So I love learning algebra. And I just think like the idea of learning like how to do these sort of matrix operations at a low level would be wildly cool.
And the idea that you could maybe apply some of that through like an extension, I don't know if Python's still your primary.
No, absolutely. So there's a Python tooling as well to do CUDA programming, but I think it's relatively new. So yeah, that was sort of what caught my attention. But who knows? Maybe I will start doing CPython in 5 years. I don't know. I'm still working my way through the C book. So like...
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, what's the best way that people can follow your work right now?
So I am on Blue Sky and I'm on Mastodon and I'm also on LinkedIn. So if you want to ping me on any of them, you can find me.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. We'll include a link to the JetBrains blog. Then people can follow your progress there as a developer advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jody, it's always fun to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on again.
Always a pleasure. And yeah, thanks for letting me talk about something that's not quite Python, but I think very relevant right now.
Oh, yeah. No, I think I think it's on a lot of people's minds. So, All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
And don't forget, if you're working with any timestamp data in your Python projects, you owe it to yourself to try the right tool for the job. InfluxDB makes time series data effortless. Whether you're building analytics dashboards, monitoring applications, or tracking performance metrics, join millions of developers who've already made the switch. Get started today at influxdata.com/realpython and see the difference the right database makes. I want to thank Jody Burchell for coming back on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to The Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that The Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.